Welcome to TSG Talk. TSG Talk aims to contribute positively towards the care of an injured casualty or vulnerable patient. If your goal is to maximise your input for the people you care for, then TSG Talk is for you. Our podcast will interview colleagues who are at the cutting edge of their professions. Often they're involved in creating solutions for areas that historically have proven difficult or have a wealth of experience in a particular complex response. Each podcast will provide unique, engaging content. At TSG Associates, we will always strive to ensure our solutions are ahead of the curve and positively impact on the quest for prioritising survival and minimising suffering. We believe TSG Talk will complement our vision and provide a platform to enhance your response. It is my pleasure to now pass you across to our host, Senior Partner at TSG, Colin Smart.
Welcome everyone to the latest edition of our podcast, TSG Talk. On many of our podcasts, we explore the unique challenges of providing medical care in complex environments. Today is no exception. Responding to an incident where there are multiple casualties who have significant thermal injuries will rank as one of the most difficult events that we could attend. And to understand some of the challenges these events present and provide guidance on how we can be as effective as possible, we are privileged tonight to talk with Chrissy Siles. Chrissy is the Client Liaison Manager at Lady and a Burns and Plastic Surgery Nurse Specialist. So good morning, Chrissy. It's fantastic to see you. Thank you for being a guest on TSG Talk. How are you today?
Yes, I'm good. Thanks very much, Colin. Lovely to be here with you.
No, it's fantastic to see you. I think the last time we met, we were in a tent somewhere in Lancashire doing lectures together, if I remember right.
And it was brilliant. Attacked by horseflies.
Attacked by horseflies and sunshine, which was a bit different to today. So but never mind. So hopefully we'll get a chance to do that again sometime soon. Chrissy, look, it's great to see you today. I thought it'd be wonderful to get you on the pod after listening to your lecture when we were lecturing across in Lancashire a few months ago. But just before we go into the actual subject tonight, could you just give our listeners a little bit of your background and where you've really been involved in burn cares and really, you know, how you've become so interested and so experienced in the subject?
That is a very good question. So I qualified as a nurse in 2003, and as part of my nurse training, the specialist lecture series that we got, one of them was from a burns nurse from a regional burns unit. He came and presented for a couple of hours, showing all sorts of images, as you can imagine, of thermal injuries, chemical injuries. And a lot of my friends who were sat around me were turning away in disgust from the screen. Kind of lots of people were like, I can't do this. I can't even look at it. And something just clicked for me. I just looked at the severely injured patients that you then need to manage and support throughout their lifetime. I thought that's the kind of nursing I want to be doing. So I asked very quickly whether I could go for an elective placement on the burns unit. And as soon as I qualified, I got a job there. So once on the burns unit, the joy of it was that you could work either on the burns ward, you could scrub in burns theatre, support the operations, you could work in an outpatients where patients come back for their dressings. So very quickly, you got the full circle of the patient's journey whilst they're with you in hospital. But then you quickly realise that once the wounds are healed, that's not the end of the journey for a lot of our patients. And actually, the care that you need to support them with is lifelong. So my journey really in burn care was initially as a staff nurse. And then I got interested in education. I started teaching as part of the new role as a burn care advisor for the region, and started dealing with professionals who treat our patients first. So that was fire service, that was paramedics, first responders, emergency departments. And that unlocked a whole new world for me, because most people probably don't realize that the patient is never taken directly from scene to the burn service. Normally, they have to go through multiple services of care before they arrive within a specialist unit. So my priority was always to make sure that those first responders, those first services, first professionals are armed and ready with knowledge required to care for thermal injury, chemical injury, casualty, so that we optimize their outcome. So decades become years or months of care rather than a lifelong commitment.
No, that
So
that's
that's
that.
me.
Okay, fantastic, and it's a wonderful history, and it's interesting. A couple of things I picked up from that is that when is somebody has a thermal injury on scene, it's I mean, we're seeing, I think, with a lot of pre-hospital care, we go directly to cardiac units, or we're directly to stroke units. But at the moment, what I understand what you're saying is we don't do that at the moment with burns. We have to go through probably, was it A&E assessment, and then move to the burn. So there's no direct admission to the burn unit at the moment.
No, the trauma care pathway at the moment is that the patient's treated at scene, usually by the emergency services, and then they will get taken either to the nearest trauma unit or a trauma centre, most of which are rarely co-located with a burn service. So that means from the patient's point of view, they are initially taken to the first A&E department where they're further stabilised, treated, and then referred to the specialist unit, and then they're taken to the specialist units on a secondary ambulance trip. So by the time we, a specialist, will receive a patient, can be many, many hours later after the injury has actually occurred. So that's an important thing to be aware of, that the burn services are rarely on your doorstep. So what you do, those first responders, the professional services that attend that casualty, the care is ever so more important because the specialist just can't be there, right then.
Okay, no, that I think that's such an interesting point so early on in this conversation, is that there is direct access doesn't happen. So what we do in the pre-hospital care, the early hospital care, is going to be vital to the out, I would think, the ultimate outcome of that patient. So that's going to be, and it's an area I'd love to explore about how we can maximize our care as you know, sort of pre-specialist providers at various stages as we chat through this morning. Before we look at maybe dealing burns and where there's multiple people involved, could you just give us an idea of why treating people with burns or wider thermal injuries? Because it was interesting you said there's thermal, there's chemical, and I suppose airway is something we have to think about as well. Why is it, would you pick out any differences when you're looking at burns, and why do you think they could sometimes be more complex to deal with than our, what we class as normal trauma?
Absolutely. One of the key things with the term burns is that it actually is an umbrella term, like a summary term for many different mechanisms of how we can injure our soft tissues. So the thermal mechanisms will be your flame injury, your scalds, your contact burns, and your frostbite injuries. But also you will then have chemical injuries, which can be either acid or alkali. You can also have electrical burns. You could have radiation burns. You could have friction burns. And yet, whenever the burn service will receive a referral, it normally is, I have a patient with a burn for you. And that's why we need to be very specific about what was the injuring mechanism, because sometimes the care pathway is dependent on that particular trauma. So for thermal, for example, we will cool. For chemical, we would irrigate quite diligently. For electrical injury, your actually primary concern will initially be internal damage, so muscle nerve damage, and whether the patient's actually conscious and still alive. So you wouldn't be thinking, oh, skin, you'd be thinking then cardiac arrest. So priorities of care will differ based on the type of mechanism involved. And that's why it's important to stipulate, but how did they get injured? So we're not just fussy, we're very, very fussy in the burn specialty.
No, and I think that makes an awful lot of sense, and I think the way you described it as an burns is the umbrella description of the injury, but actually it has to be, you know, to get the correct pathway as soon as possible, we have to get that specific mechanism to start that patient pathway treatment correct. It's interesting. I do like that phrase, the umbrella sort of description of of the injury. When you're teaching sort of pre-specialist providers and pre-hospital providers in burns, is there any sort of areas you consistently find that they struggle with that you find that your input can help them with at all?
It's interesting that often we get quite preoccupied with kind of the clever stuff. Everybody wants to have looked after a major burn patient, big severe burns, but those are so rare, and the numbers are declining that actually our skill set is diminishing. So there's always the kind of the nervousness about, well, I've not ever seen in my career, I've never seen a major burn, and now all of a sudden I'm attending a scene where that there is a major burn patient. So there's always the worry that you're going to need to do really clever stuff to make them well. And actually, the one thing that I always draw back on in teaching is that it's the very, very basics of care. So the same approach that you would take to the trauma patient: they're bleeding, stop the bleed. They're not breathing, let's make them breathe for us, you know, that kind of stuff. And they've got a thermal injury, well, let's cool it, you know, or they're really cold, let's warm them. So it often is the very, very basics of care. And you have to almost remove the kind of the super skilled kind of headset the professionals will turn up going, I've got all this kit. And you think, no, you don't need any of that. You need to do the very, very basics. What do we need to do? The key things, that's one of the things that we always find errors with, is the pre-hospital or pre-specialist burn size and depth assessment. So those are one of the areas where a lot of time is wasted on how big is this burn, how deep is this burn. And ultimately, we know that trauma estimation of burn size and depth is inaccurate. And the reason for that is that you haven't got the capacity, or nor should you have capacity, to clean the wound bed properly so you can actually estimate the full size of the injury properly. The environment is not appropriate for it, nor has the patient got the time for it, nor does it really affect the care that you're going to give to that patient. So there are apps like the Mersey Burns app, for example. So if you're really stuck and you don't want to do complex math, it allows you to draw on the body map on the screen, and it will tell you the approximate size estimation of that burn. The reason why we normally like to know the size of the burn is that we need to decipher whether it's a major burn, and the major burn in an adult is anything over 15%. In a child, it's anything over 10% surface area. If it's big burn, if it's a resuscitation size injury, they will require fluids, they will require very different management, and they're quite likely will need to go to a burn center rather than a burns unit who can handle managing severely injured casualties. Now, ultimately, all the pre-hospital care providers really need to do is estimate, is this a burn that's bigger than 15% in an adult and bigger than 10% in a child? Because that will mean I need to put up my bag of fluid and then we need to go. Nothing else needs to happen. But yet, quite often, there's a little bit of deliberation. Is it 23%? Is it 28%? It really doesn't matter. The numbers are just semantics. So, big burn, let's give fluids, let's keep them warm, and let's go. So I think that's the bit where we normally get stuck with the assessment. And depth assessment really doesn't need to feature in a pre-hospital care environment. If it's deep or if it's partial thickness, leave the burn services to work that out. Because the reason we want to know that is whether they need surgery, whether they just need a dressing that will heal by it, the wound will heal by itself. So pre-hospital care providers don't really necessarily need to know the depth of the burn injury. Size, big enough to resus, big enough to transfer to a major trauma center, which means they'll eventually go to a burns center rather than a burns unit. And that's all that matters.
Okay, no, that's really interesting, and I think one of the consistent points I'm getting from talking to an awful lot of our guests on TSG Talk is do the basics really well. That there's a place for the complex stuff, but it's often in very minimum cases. But the vast majority of people need the basics done incredibly well, and that seems to be a consistent theme we get from everybody at talks with us on their specific areas. The other area I really liked about that was your assessment of big burn, little burn. I know one of the best things I probably learned as a remote medic over the years
was assessments are very important, given history is very important, but actually what everybody wanted to know at each point on the evacuation chain was it big sick or little sick? I tell you,
That's it.
it is quite interesting how different specialities often come back to the most crude sort of assessment. Is this big or little? Because if it's big, this will equal this resource, and if it's little, it's a different set of management that have to take place. So that's almost crudeness, which is probably the wrong word for it, of assessment. Seems to be relevant to an awful lot of other specialities as well. But
It takes
that's
away the bandwidth. You know, it gives you the bandwidth to cope with what you actually need to deal with and takes away the bits that you don't even need to think about. So definitely, yeah, big burn, little burn is just simplify it so you can actually treat them with the resources you have and the capacity you have.
Yeah. And I suppose if you hear that word big burn, then all of a sudden your resources are ramping up to reflect what's going to be coming through your door. No, very interesting. So as we've discussed, there's a lot to burns, and there's a lots of very specific areas that all sit under the one umbrella word of burns. Just, I suppose, to make it even more complicated, if you come across multiple casualty burns in a pre-hospital environment, and I think here I'm not talking like the disaster zone, but maybe something like a car fire where people have been trapped, and you've maybe got five or six people with different levels of some form of thermal injury. What would be the complexity something like that would bring to a pre-hospital provider? Because I say, I think you're right that the big burn in pre-hospital care is quite rare, and I should say some of the by the fact we don't deal with it all the time, we're often drawn on a skill set that hasn't been practiced on a regular basis. But significant burns with multiple people as a responder. Well, any challenges that you could probably indicate to our listeners that they might be faced with, and how they would deal with something like this?
Well, you know what? In a sense, when I teach, I always stipulate that before the burn, what you're looking at is a trauma patient. And interestingly enough, we always preoccupy ourselves with, well, I'm going to a major burns trauma. But actually, skin comes way down the pecking order in your ATLS survey. So you need to just consider that, yes, it's the very visual injury, it is an assault on your senses and it is incredibly traumatic to witness, and especially if you have multiple casualties. And like you say, we're not talking necessarily about, you know, 2050, where we can be talking literally about a small handful of patients that becomes all of a sudden really tricky and really challenging for you to manage. But ultimately, always consider them as a trauma patient. They are your trauma patients. What would you do for them? If an airway breathing is a concern, we deal with that first, way before the burn. If the circulation, if it's a polytrauma, that trumps the burn injury. Skin takes a long time to declare. So the burn depth, for example, takes up to 3 days to declare its full extent of injury. We have time in terms of burn injury itself. What we might not have time with is if they were entrapped and they were breathing in product of combustion, they might have carbon monoxide poisoning, they might have cyanide poisoning, they might have a smoke inhalation injury. So then you're stuck on the B or A and B, and then you need to deal with that. So ultimately, just be very aware that of the mechanism of burn injury. And if it's play flame background, so flame mechanism, and they were stuck inside a burning building, inside a burning car, it's a box that had fire and that would have had the products of combustion. You know for sure they're going to have some sort of smoke inhalation damage to their lungs, and you're going to have to manage their airway and their breathing. History from seeing you mentioned that this, how important it is in trauma. It's something that quite often is lacking at the point of handover. Like I said, the burn survivors will travel through ambulance services to A&E and then eventually to the burns unit. When they arrive, quite often we'll get, well, they were in a house fire. There you go, your patient. So the history is really important. Were they stuck in a building? Did they walk out of the burning building? Did they collapse and continued staying there until they were extricated out of the burning building? Did they jump out of the burning building? So whilst, yes, the primary will be they all have a burn, but ultimately, you know, the one that walked out will have a less significant smoke inhalation injury than the one that got entrapped and stayed inside of the building and had to be rescued. The one that jumped out potentially actually has a polytrauma that is a priority rather than the burn injury itself. So that's with a single casualty. add that into a multiple, and all of a sudden you're having to prioritize your trauma patients based on the injuries incurred, priority of which might not be the burn injury itself. So you always have to think the burn injury will mask potentially other trauma. If it was an RTC, is there other trauma? Or if it was a blast injury, actually, yes, I can see the burn, but what other injuries are underneath the burn that currently are masking it? So you could have your hemorrhaging patient, but actually, because you're looking at the burn, thinking, oh, they're major burn, we need to deal with the burn. And they're going to die on you because all you're thinking about E element rather than the ABC element. So with major trauma casualties, I would say it is no different to you managing your trauma patients. You prioritize in order of appearance as you would for any kind of ATLS approach, bearing in mind that a major incident for a burn is anything over normally two patients. So your local burn service will have a couple of intensive care beds that potentially may be taken up, and they may have four, six ward beds that may be available. Once that's exhausted, you have to go network wide and look for the next available burn bed. And if the network doesn't have it, you have to go into another network. So potentially the patients have to travel a really long way whilst they're being incredibly sick. And you might have to separate families because pediatric beds might not be available on your doorstep. And you might have to go Bristol, Manchester, really out of the way for somewhere to deliver the best care for that casualty. So all of these considerations will come a little bit further down the line. And ultimately, we are here as a burn specialist to support that decision-making process. But at the scene, they're trauma patients. Deal with them as trauma patients, and burn injury comes much further down the line.
Okay. No, I think that again, it's going back to simplifying what on the visually is a very complex scene we could be dealing with. But yeah, I think, as I say, take away the complexity of the burn injury and go back to what do you understand from the trauma casualty and treat us that way. I think it's always good when you're working pre-hospitally, especially in an instance that you maybe haven't dealt with on a routine basis, to have something to have something to, I suppose, a hook to hang your coat on. And I think just keeping that maybe in your head that this is a trauma patient, what would be my normal process to assess this patient, then apply the appropriate treatment is, yeah, I think that's a very, very good point. Go back to basics. What would you do for trauma? Don't get too sort of driven by the visualization of the burn injury and the complexity that might be sort of communicating with you. That's an absolute super point. I thought one point I picked up which I thought was really interesting, and it's something, if we look at sort of more general multiple casualty management, it's the separation of the child and the adult to go to the, because as you say, definitive care can be limited, especially in the more specialist areas. So, and I think that's something organizations probably need to think about. If you were to separate a child, what would be the psychological care along that transportation route we need to provide that child? Because we know separation, especially with very young children, from their primary caregiver, primary sort of parent or caregiver, is really important to them. So I think there's a consideration and a logistics and the thought process needs to go. If you are going to separate to get to specialist units, how do you support that child along the way? Because it's going to be traumatic for the adult, but the child has got quite specific needs. So
Absolutely. It
that.
takes me back to how we would treat a child who's undergoing even elective surgery. You always have the mum or dad at the bedside as they go to sleep, and you have mum or dad at the bedside as they wake up. There's always the person who loves them and cares for them, who they find as reassuring as possible to be near them. But in this instance, potentially mum or dad are also injured, maybe even unconscious, and maybe have died. And all of a sudden, you're in this incredibly traumatic situation as a first responder, where you can't help but be emotionally connected to the situation. But then on top of that, like you say, you might have to separate the family to transfer the patients to, where the resources lie to support their best possible outcome. And if the parents can't go with the child, who can? Bear in mind that unlike trauma services, burn services are commissioned to have massive psychological support for the patients, for the family, and that is lifelong. So from the point of admission, we will have clinical psychologists, we have counselors, and all of the bedside clinicians are also quite skilled in that counseling and psychological welfare piece as well. So they're not gonna go unsupported, but that journey there with the pre-hospital care providers or the transfer specialists actually could be quite traumatic for the child, for the parent as well in that moment. And maybe just knowledge that actually where they arrive, they will get all the support, they will be in the best place. Maybe that's something that pre-hospital care providers can actually reassure the family with, is that it's horrible right now, but ultimately the outcome will be much optimized by going to the places where you're all going to.
No, it's a fascinating, and it's quite a unique area, but it is fascinating. It's been really interesting with, I think we're on our 19th edition of TSG Talk, but one of the things that does keep coming through is the ability and the importance of soft skills when we're treating seriously injured people in vulnerable scenarios. And there's a few editions where we talk to vastly experienced people who's been responding to multiple casualties, but we've also been talking to people who've been seriously injured. And when you talk about when you get the feedback from the patient or the carer, and say the carer is talking to the patient post-incident saying, how did it go? The one thing they remember is somebody holding their hand and saying they're going to be okay. And when you talk to
Absolutely.
the when you talk to the actual injured people, they say, what do you remember from the treatment? It was that caring competence and somebody holding their hand saying they were okay. And I think, I suppose when we're now talking about separation of children, maybe that is part of the logistics we should think about, is that whether it's hand holding or whether it's that comfort person, whoever that may be, but maybe we don't isolate that child to be in a clinical case. We've got to think of the emotional part from point of when we initiate point of care. How can we maintain that if they're not with the adult? Because I know we're off slightly on a tangent, as we tend to do on TSG Talk, but it is something that comes up a lot, and I think the application of soft skills cannot be underestimated in the job that we do, and even more so with children who have been separated from their primary caregiver. It's an important point, I think, and
I
probably one that
agree
you
with that,
yeah.
actually, Colin. There are two things. One of the things is that when we started talking, we said about simplifying things and moving away from the clever gadgetry and technological solutions to actually the very basics. And the very basics is if somebody is upset and they're near you, you would comfort them. It's a natural human nature to hold a hand, to speak to them, to just be in that moment present with them. Because if it was you or if it was somebody you love and care about, that's what you would want somebody to do for you or for that person. Just to be human. Side to side, hold hands, acknowledge, yes, this is a bit rubbish right now. It is really difficult, but this is what's going to happen. And I do find you're correct. Patients do find you talking through, this is what's happening right now. This is what we're expecting will happen in the next 10 minutes. And to just have an idea of the timeline, even when you're in pain and intolerable kind of situation, just knowing that there's an end or that there's something good is coming or there's relief coming, that makes things, the experience for that patient better. So that's one point. Back to the basics, hold hands, speak to each other. The other thing that made me think about is actually first responders that attend households where a child has been injured. So a child has sustained normally a scald burn, and the parents are quite understandably stressed, sometimes even quite angry, and they just want the first responders to grab them and go to the hospital. And actually, the first responders' role will be in guiding the parents to try and instruct how to do first aid. If there's no A and B and C issues, which normally there aren't with pediatric scalds, you have to stay, you have to do the first aid. But the parents often don't understand how essential that is. So they want to rush, they want to go to the hospital to see the doctor, to see the specialist. And those soft skills really come into the fore because you're having to persuade potentially somebody who's been quite confrontational, quite anxious, quite in your face about the importance of why we need to stay, why we need to deliver this cooling. And that's the knowledge of the consequence. And that's, I hope, the first aiders and first responders and professional services who attend before the specialists get involved, they know that without doing the first aid, without doing the cooling, the important first bit, you lose track of time, time perishes, and then you lose the opportunity to reverse the damage for that child. And then the burn services have to get involved, and the burn services have to do the surgery and skin grafting, and the child does end up with a scar. And yet, if you stand strong and utilize your soft skill, utilize the understanding, comprehension of the angst that the parents experience, and then just reassure them and explain why it's important to stay and cool and do that first thing, we can potentially avoid the consequence for that child and for that family that could be life-changing and lifelong.
Yeah. So again, I think it's reinforcing the point. Do the basics well. Soft skills are important. It doesn't have often. It's not the complex stuff. It's the basics done well. And actually seeing control going into very emotionally charged scenarios is really is a major part of what you're bringing to the care of the individual and the wider scene. No, it's absolutely fascinating what we're bringing out here. Just again, I suppose going back to a little bit of multiple casualties. I mean, if you look at our sort of standard pre-hospital bags that we all carry, we've got various bits of equipment to deal with things we do on a regular basis. Is there any specific, say we were dealing with maybe four or five moderately seriously injured people, but I'll pick a vehicle accident because they probably happen more often than not. Is there any bits of equipment we should be thinking about, or the volume of equipment we might have to be thinking about to assist their response? Any thoughts on that at all?
One of the things that actually came out a few years ago is when I worked with the fire service and recognized the extraordinary resource that they pretend that they have at their fingertips for our burn survivors. And quite often they're underutilized by the ambulance service and by, the professionals that first turn up to the scene. Actually, the best way to do it is to speak to your fire service, even if they're not responding, which normally they would be with an RTC scenario. Use the big tank of water, or get them to give you access to the water hydrant. They're like your best resource to deliver the cooling element, and also potentially on mass casualty level. Just think of the decontamination tents that can be set up by the HART teams, like when you do have a mass casualty event and people just walk through the showers. There are many really clever solutions to how we can manage multiple casualty events and still deliver your trauma initial care. But if there's no ABCD issues, we can then move on to the fact, what does the burn injury actually require here? And it requires cooling, and then it requires warming. So essential bits of kit, I would say, is that if you are the first responder, you are the emergency service traveling to the reports of multiple burns casualties, you need to have a water strategy, because water's going to be important. But equally, the saying "cool the burn, warm the patient" still stands. And if you're responding right now, it's really, really cold outside. I wouldn't want to stand out there and you pouring cold water on me. So being very mindful of the fact that, yes, whilst they need cooling, is now the time to be doing it? And if now is not the time to be cooling them here, we park that and we hand it over to the next treating service that maybe could do it in a more controlled environment, like in an emergency department. But that handover of first aid done or first aid not done is lost in translation and is often doesn't form part of the essential handover to the next treating service. So I would say, remember first aid. If not done, you hand over the responsibility to the next service that can do this safely. And if you're not doing cooling, then it's warming. If you think about a major burn casualty, they are in organ failure. Their major organ, the biggest organ we have, our skin, has failed. And skin is responsible for thermoregulation and making sure that we stay warm and we contain our core temperature. As soon as skin is lost, you're wet, you get radiant heat losses, and you become very, very cold very, very quickly. So what do you have in your kit that can contain the temperature? So you will never increase the body heat pre-hospitally, but you can stop them from getting colder. And normally the advice is to wrap them in cling film as much as you can. Cover all the exposed wet areas with cling film and then wrap, 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 whatever else you have, your foil blankets, your cotton blankets, your bubble wrap, whatever else, just don't expect it to create miracles. You're never going to all of a sudden find a casualty at 37 degrees warm. Mm-hmm. That's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. They're going to be cold. They're going to be 35 degrees or less, and they're going to be getting colder unless you protect them from the environment. So that those would be my two pennies worth. It's cool if you can within the controlled medium. If they're getting cold, you wrap, you keep them warm, and you transfer them with the handover that first aid hasn't happened. Bear in mind, first aid is only effective within 3 hours of injury. So if you are past that window, first aid is no longer effective. So that's where the consideration of, okay, we can't call all of them, but potentially I could do upper limbs or I could do faces, because those are the areas that are going to matter to them in the long term. Let's prioritize the bits that will matter to them most and the bits that we can do pre-hospitally before we travel.
Fascinating. And I think one of the, I suppose there's two points I got from that is if you think you could respond to multiple casualties with burns, you have to think diversely about where your equipment's coming from. I should say, talk to the fire service. Who's got access to large quantities of clean water? How would I get that to the scene? How would I contain it? There's probably answers there to everything, but I think the individuals and the organisations need to think through the process before they turn up, because it'll be a complex problem on the day. But if you've thought it through, it's an easier problem to solve. And you've hit an absolutely fascinating subject of hypothermia and burns, which you know I like my hypothermia research. I do, it's a personal opinion, but I do believe we don't address hypothermia generally that well pre-hospital. I think there's enough research to say that we're delivering way too many trauma patients cold. But I think with burns, we have that added complexity. You're right, we've lost that thermoregulation. But I think it gets even more complex because, as you said before, it's a trauma casualty. So we've got blood loss and we've got hypothermia, we're now into lethal triad, and we know that's going to reduce survivability. So it's not something, it's not an extra consideration, it's a major consideration on how we deal with it. I don't think it's an easy one to solve because it's complex, but I think we have to consider it. And if you do think you're going to come across that sort of casualty, I think you have to pre-think what you're going to do. And
in reality, polytrauma and burns is very rare. It is so, so rare. So it's unlikely that they would have burns and something else that's like catastrophic hemorrhage. It's very unlikely. But you are correct. They still will be your lethal triad patients. There still will be coagulopathic. There will still be acidotic. And they will be very, very cold. And they just keep going around in that circle, around that triangle, until we've managed to fix at least one of those. And unless we fix the hypothermia element and start actively warming them, which in true terms can only happen once to get to emergency department and we start pummeling warmed fluid and bear huggers all over them, nothing's going to happen pre-hospitally. So we need to kind of just acknowledge our limitation in pre-hospital environment, but we don't want to make it worse. You know, the whole point of first aid is to offset the damage that can happen further down the line. It's prevention, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And same with hypothermia. You're trying to prevent that horrible, horrible outcome. And in burns, hypothermia is independently responsible for mortality in burn casualties. So it is a big deal for us. We don't want them cold. We want them as warm as possible. And all the measures need to happen in that conundrum of, I need to cool them, Chrissy said, but then I also need to warm them. How do I do this? And that's where my challenge to the fire service and responding services is that I want the water that you're delivering, like you said, it needs to be clean. And if it's dirty, can we filter it? The flow needs to be acceptable. You don't want to put a jet on a person because that would be intolerable. It needs to be your shower kind of gentle flow. And it also needs to be warmed. Ideally, I'd like it set at a specific body temperature warm so that it actually is as effective as it can be and doesn't cool the casualty. So I'm sure there's a gadget somewhere that can make this happen so we don't get all these burn survivors even colder at the scene. But at the moment, we don't have it.
Yeah. And the more you talk about the dynamics involved in it, the more I'm thinking the best solution to being really good at this is to really think it through before you turn up on scene. To have those little discussions in a group saying, what if we get this type of casualty? What are the resources we may be able to pull upon? Is there that magic piece of kit it exists that is getting used for something else? And again, I don't have the answers, but this maybe the pathway to optimum patient outcome on scene is thinking, well, if this is what we're faced with, this is what we can do to fill the gap. But actually, what's our evacuation pathway like? So it's as slick as possible. So we're not in the uncontrolled environment where we know we've got minimum input on hypothermia, but we know hypothermia care is really important on survivability. So I think there's a lot of just to sit around in the little groups and just chat it through and think about the ins and outs of how you would do it locally would go a massive way to making sure you perform it effective on scene. Because it
One
is,
of the
you're right,
things that
it's.
your listeners might find useful is the report that I published with a co-author of mine, David Wales, and it's called Saving Lives is Not Enough. And one of the elements that are recommended for how fire service can optimize the outcome for burn survivors is called have a water strategy. It's exactly what you're saying. We're going at some point, we will be called out to a burns casualty or somebody in the house fire, or maybe even multiple casualties. How are we going to manage this? Ideally, we have domestic property, there's water on scene, we're going to use that. If that's not available, what's our next best thing? Can we use the hydrant? Can we use the appliance water? If we're up in the sticks in the middle of the mountain and we don't have access to clean running water, we can't get appliance to it. What's the next best thing? Ah, we have 3 hours. Okay, potentially we can transfer them, hand over, no first aid was done. You still have, say, an hour left. All of this stuff, you need to have it as a plan. Best thing, second best thing, okay, we do what we can kind of thing. It needs to be a stepwise approach, but normally we tend to turn up and go, oh no, burn casualties. How we're going to manage them now. But if we have a plan, usually it will work out a lot better.
Yeah, have a plan. It's a good phrase, isn't it? Have a plan. And funny enough, the response, you know, as I say, just might be that more effective. So I think what I'm really picking up from this is a lot of the success of your care on scene will be related to how much preparation and thought you've put into how you will respond, because there's other things to think about. You won't be doing that often, but the thinking it through and looking at the different objectives you're trying to get to is going to be a massive benefit when you have to react quickly to a very complex scene. Absolutely fascinating.
And that's with
Just
the
yeah.
hypothermia a bit. Like just, I think the tendency is, you know, we talked about the inaccuracy of pre-hospital assessment of burn. If you're laying them out on the salvage sheet on the ground somewhere pre-hospitally whilst you're waiting for the ambulance to arrive, or they've arrived and you're trying to kind of sort out how you're going to get them on the trolley or package them up, they're laying there exposed. So potentially, if you do need to do that initial kind of head-to-toe assessment, you could do a segmental assessment. They don't need to be all exposed all at once. You can do a bit at a time, you know, one limb at a time almost. The rest of them needs to stay covered up. And I think I can't stress it enough how important heat loss or preventing heat loss is for burn survivors.
I think that's again part of my summary. It will be picking up on heat loss. No, really, really good point. I often find one of the great ways to learn is to tell a story. Is there any from your wide experience in burns, is there any experiences that you've had personally that you think it would be useful to tell the story that our listeners might learn from? Anything particular comes to mind?
Oh, there's always a story, isn't there?
Stories are good. Stories are good.
So if anybody's ever seen me present, I often will conclude my talk with two stories, two toddlers, separately injured, but ultimately the same injury of a pull down scald. Mum's at home, very busy, doing other stuff, kettle boiled. Poured a cup of tea, inquisitive toddler comes up and has a and pulls the cup over their head and their chest. I think we're so preoccupied with talking about major burns, mass casualty events, we almost forget that burns can happen every day in a very everyday circumstance around us as parents, as godparents, as brothers and sisters, just in our own family setting. So if we just make it home base, make it real for you and me. So, my personal story was that my little boy was three, and I took him to one of the coffee chains, and He wanted a cookie. We gave him hot chocolate. It was his birthday. We were celebrating. I had some drink that I wanted to have some sprinkles or something on top of it, and I thought I'm going to give him a job. He's going to go over to that counter over there and grab me the thing. At the same time, there was a lady there who was doing the same thing to her coffee, standing at the stand. He was so tiny, he literally fitted under her elbow. And as she went to move away, her elbow hit the top of his head and her hot drink spilt on his head. So I'm in this coffee chain, this tiny little toddler's holding his breath, running across to me. I can see the tears welling up in his eyes. His head is red. I'm thinking, oh God, I'm a burns nurse. This shouldn't be happening to me. What's happened? The woman carried on walking, sat down, and carried on chatting to her friend, didn't even realize what happened. So I ran up to the counter, go, my child's just got burned. Can I get some cold water? And I get handed a cup with some ice in it. And that just goes to show how the everyday knowledge that you think, well, everybody knows this. You know, you burn yourself, you cool the burn, but people don't know. And that's the thing that it really kind of drove home to me. I said, no, I'm sorry, this is useless. I need a cloth. I need some water. So again, ice tipped out, water, cloth, and I just sit there doing these compresses over his head, this poor distressed child. And I suppose that is the story. I mean, he's fine and nothing happened and it was superficial and it didn't blister, but people don't know what to do. People don't know what to do when a burn injury happens. And in the case of those two children that I present at the end of every talk, one didn't have first aid and ended up going on to have skin graft operation, ended up with a scar that he still wears to this day as an adult. And the other one, whose mum actually, while she said it was the worst scenario of her life, it was the most traumatic experience, and actually watching her child's skin bubbling in front of her eyes was really incredibly stressful. And she was full of emotion. She said, I called 999 and I nearly drowned him in a bath full of water. I sat him in and I did the cooling. I did the thing. And he ended up with no scarring at all. So I think, if anything we take away from today is those basics, but the basics have a time frame. The clock is ticking from the time the injury happens. And what public don't know is that 20 minutes of cooling with warm water is effective first aid, and it's only effective within 3 hours from the time of the burn injury. So don't expect that I'll get to the paramedics or I'll get to the A&E department or I'll get to the burns unit and then they'll do the right things. You are there first. You are the best first aider for that child, for that loved one, for the person who got injured. If you don't do first aid, the next service quite often will assume that that's already been done because that's not clever stuff. And we want to do clever stuff. So do first aid and always assume it's not been done. If it's within 3 hours of injury and the parent arrives with the child, I will always disbelieve their story that they've done first aid and I'll do my own 20 minutes because I know that then it's definitely been done.
Fantastic. Well, that's again going back to the basics, but again, I think that story brings it such a pertinent point. So I really appreciate you bringing that story out. Just before I summarise, and I have got about half a page of notes to try and summarise on, which could be quite interesting. One question we ask all of our guests on THG Talk is, if you were to always have one piece of medical kit on you, regardless of where you are, what do you think that would be?
Oh, that's a really interesting one. And actually, when you sent me the questions, I asked my husband. I said to him, oh, this is a really tricky one. They want to know what kit I would take. He went, when it comes to Chrissy style, she just needs to have a tea bag in her bag.
A tea bag. Well, I've never had that one.
Ultimately, the joy of the fact that my specialty is burn care is that I don't need to bring the kit. Wherever there are humans, I expect there to be water. And if I could bring something with me, it would be water. But if I can't bring it on volume with me, because remember, I have to bring 20 minutes worth, I have to have a water strategy. I have to think, well, actually, I'm in someone's house and they have a tap and they have a shower or they have a bath or they have a sink. What can I use? Can I use a hose pipe in the garden? Always have a plan as to what I could do. And actually, one of the things that brought things to the fore was yesterday's very sad attack on a young mum with her two children. And the news were reporting that before the professional services had arrived, actually the bystanders were there, opening their front doors, encouraging her into their bathrooms, into their showers, and delivering first aid. That's the thing. Is that people will help, people will intervene, and people will find water, even if it doesn't seem like it's readily available anywhere. So, for those casualties that have come out of a burning house, yes, that house might be gutted, but there are all of the neighboring properties that potentially have a very workable shower where you can actually knock on the door and say, "Do you mind if we use your shower?" Because that's way more controlled than doing it on a salvage sheet on the grass at the front of the house. So, I would say, water is the thing that I could bring, but I don't have to because I'll always have a plan. I'll always think, where can I source it? And if I can't source this, my husband's ex-fire service, I know that these big boys and girls can bring it to me. If you utilize their resource, they will make water happen for you. So don't forget that you don't have to have all the solutions by yourself. Bring a friend or loads of them, and they'll come with a clever kit that can actually be helpful too. So that's my answer.
Yes, I like that answer. It's a fascinating question. And throughout the, I think, the 18, 19 episodes that we've done so far, some people bring treatment equipment, some people bring management equipment. We had one guest brought a whistle because that's the best way to manage the scene. Some people bring knowledge, so they'd want a specific book with them or access to information. And I think it's very relevant what you say. You bring in a plan because you know the piece of equipment you want, you cannot carry. But actually bringing the plan so you can access that piece of equipment, I think is a wonderful way to think about it. And again, I think it's something we can get hold of as individuals and say, well, what would be the thing I would always have? And if it's your strategy in your head how to access your equipment, I like that. I think that's fantastic. But we'll always give you a tea bag as well. Nobody should be around without a tea bag. So,
Exactly, exactly
so
my point.
I
Well, one of
think.
the things I would just add to that kind of summary, is one of the things that I've learned from working for many years with the pre-hospital care providers, that they are genius at problem solving despite not having the right kit or the right resource. One of the things recently, I was teaching Surrey search and rescue teams, and one of the paramedics, Lou from South East Coast Ambulance, she said, "Well, yeah, we only carry one bottle of water in the back of the truck, but actually, what I do is I pour water into a sick bowl and then cool by pouring over the limb or whatever is affected into another sick bowl and just keep rotating." I thought, this is genius because en route to the hospital, you're still able to do first aid cooling, but not actually make a right old mess of the place and waste all of your precious 1 liter water resource by using it that way. So I reckon there are a whole body of solutions that pre-hospital care community have come up with for how to manage burn survivors despite not having the right thing. But they come with a plan. Like you say, come with a plan or have that genius element where you can troubleshoot and problem solve on the scene. It's incredible. I just take my hats off to all of them, that they're amazing. And they treat my patients first. So they only do good in my eyes.
It's interesting you say everybody has those unique solutions that pre-hospital providers are so good at doing. I think what we might do after this, because we always promote the TSG talk through our LinkedIn pages, I think that might be a very good post to say what solutions do people have, and let's see if we can get maybe 10 or 20 solutions, and then share that with the wider community. And that's got to be a benefit to wider pre-hospital care. I think, yeah, there's absolutely. Let's put a LinkedIn post up on that and see what eureka moments we get from what people are doing.
You'll be surprised. I reckon there's some absolute corkers, absolute excellent solutions that people have come up with, but just not shared with the wider world. We all can learn from that. I would love to see those.
Yeah, let's give us a couple of weeks on that one. We'll put a LinkedIn post together. We've got quite a wide capture of people we can talk to now, and we'll see what we come up with. That would be absolutely fantastic. So I'm going to try and summarize. I've learned so much from the last 50 minutes. So let me try and summarize and see if I've captured the right bits of information. And if I haven't, then please add to it. But the big things I've taken from our conversation is that the word burns is just a big umbrella word for many types of burns and conditions that can sit within that big umbrella. And I think that's very important. There's an awful lot of things that burns sit on top of that we have to understand. I think what I've learned is that the pre-hospital care is really important because it's going to take a long time to get to specialist care. So what we do in the pre-hospital phase is hugely important. But the secret to that really good care is applying the basics really well, but understanding that the basics fit within a time frame as well. And if you understand that, you can understand why the application is important. And if you don't have a definitive solution, it will allow you to make a plan that you can adjust to get the best possible outcome. Because we never usually work in the perfect world, but understanding that I think is important. The mechanism you said is the one thing you really want to understand before when you get your patient in. So the more precise we can be in handover on mechanism, the better you can adjust your care pathway when it does get to specialist, which I think is something again we can apply pre-hospital to improve the patient outcome. Estimation, I picked up on that, and I think all the literature tells us is that estimating a burn is really difficult. And maybe we shouldn't waste too much time trying to be very specific on it. But a good way to tell what you want to hear is it a big burn or a little burn? Big burn, little burn will tell you what you need to know so you can start gearing up your services. Again, getting prepared for the best care you can give that person as they enter your facilities. Looking more at the trauma, so the multiple casualties and I suppose the seriously injured burns patient as well, is that always remember they're a trauma patient first. Although the burn itself may be a highly visible, outwardly complex looking problem, you still have to think airway, you still have to think breathing, you still have to go through your surveys and treat them as a standard trauma patient and address those problems that are going to affect the ability of survive, are going to affect survivability. So think that the burns patient is still a trauma patient. And probably, one thing I found hugely interesting and is probably worth a podcast on itself is that although we want to cool the burn, which is really important, we also have to understand that hypothermia in burns is really important as well. And to try and understand the best way to deal with that, I think we have to look at our own individual circumstances and put the plan in place. Whether the plan is fast evacuation to a warm room, or whether the plan is I can't get fast evacuation, therefore I need really good passive methods. That's going to work for a seriously injured burn person. We're going to have to think in advance how we're going to deal with that because if we don't address the hypothermia, we're going to reduce survivability, and it's important. So that's a huge thing. And I suppose the last thing I picked up was think about different ways you can access equipment you're going to need if you're having to deal with particularly one large burn patient. I should say two burns patients is a major incident, or if you're dealing with three and four, what is your water strategy? What is your cooling strategy? What's your heating strategy for your hypothermia? What's your evacuation strategy to the appropriate care? So let think about how you access your equipment. You might have to think diversely how you do that because you probably won't have that equipment in the vehicle or the kit that you're carrying. So have some diversity of thought, but make sure it's put into planning process so you've thought it through before you get there. So I think, I mean, there were many, many other points that I could have picked up, but I think that's the main ones I've picked up from today. Have I missed anything, or is there anything else you would add to that?
I think the slight difference that the burns world has taught me is that we need to stop judging our patients by the fact that they survived their injury. I think survival is something so 1940s. We were hoping that our burn injured casualties would survive, and that was great. We've done a good job because we made them live. Now the onus is on quality of life after survival. What is the impact of my actions or inactions in those first few moments, first few hours, on the way that that person is going to live their life for next decade and the rest of their life. Survival is no longer the guide. Quality of life outcome is what we should all aspire to for our patients.
Well, what a great way to summarize what we're all trying to do in all the care professions. You know, if our actions can improve the quality of life post-injury, isn't that an amazing trade to be in? No, I think that's hugely important. And I suppose one thing I actually missed in my summary is that the soft skills are actually important in that as well. It's not just about the physical cooling maintenance of body temperature. It could be, as to improve that quality of life, it could be as simple as providing emotional support all the way through the evacuation chamber, where there may be separation of a child. So absolutely fascinating. Oh, look, Chrissy, this has been fantastic. It's an area, Burns, that thankfully I've not had a lot of experience on. And I've always felt the response to that was probably limited because of actual practical knowledge in doing it. So I personally, I've learned so much from the conversation we've had this morning. So Chrissy, once again, thank you for your time today. It's been hugely enjoyable and informative to talk with you. This edition of THG Talk will be on all the major podcast sites, so please like and subscribe us. A good rating is always appreciated, and it really helps get THG Talk more visible to a wider community. So thank you, everybody, for listening. We'll be back soon again with another THG Talk. So we'll talk to you again, if we're done soon. Thank you very much. Thank you again, Chrissy.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to this edition of THG Talk. We hope you found the content of benefit. Should you have any questions or require additional information, please visit thgassociates.co.uk.